You're listening to Season 2, Episode 5 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, storytellers? We have young adult historical fantasy fiction author Kendall Culper with us today. Kendall is the author of the popular books Salt and Storm and Drift and Dagger. Both books are about witches, magic, love, betrayal, and self-discovery, all set in the 19th century in a whaling community. We'll kick off today's episode by learning how Kendall was inspired to weave in the fantasy element of magic and witchcraft into her stories. But right before we dive right into the interview, I want to share some really cool facts that I learned about Kendall during the beginning of our chat. As far back as she could remember in first grade, her teacher gave out a homework assignment where students were given three words and were asked to write a sentence for only one of those words. Kendall loved the assignment so much, she ended up writing sentences for all three words. That's the moment she realized how much she loved writing, and her love for it has never stopped. During her undergrad in Harvard, she majored in history and literature. Again, she absolutely loved to write, but this time around, Kendall felt that the idea of being an author was too abstract of an idea and too far out of her reach. So she pursued journalism for a bit, thinking it was a more practical job. But after she spent some time in journalism, Kendall realized she didn't like it and ended up giving it another shot at becoming an author. During her studies in Harvard, she learned how to strip away her own attachments and self-projection onto historically related images and documents, and was taught to step into the mindset of the person who actually created it or lived it. This skill and practice is constantly put to use in fleshing out the historical facts, the characters, and the world she's created in her books today. Now let's jump right into the part of Kendall's interview where we talk about the inspiration behind the fantasy element in her books.
Yeah, so the fantasy was something that was a little bit of a surprise to myself, that I didn't even really think that I was going to put these fantasy elements in there. And then once I did, I was really happy that I made that decision. Originally, I got the idea because the book, Salt and Storm, is about this family of witches who live on sort of like a Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard, like whaling island in the mid 19th century. And they came about from actual women who would make good luck charms or occasionally curse sailors who annoyed them. And I thought it sounded really cool and was ripe for stories, especially combined with whaling, which was another thing that I think is so fascinating. But I hadn't really, other than Moby Dick, like I don't really think anybody knows too many whaling stories. So I thought that combining the two would be a really fun way to talk about history and make it just a little bit more appealing, because I love history. I think it's really interesting, but I get that like a lot of teenagers are maybe not so into history, like it, you know, can feel sort of dry and remote. And so I thought the fantasy element was sort of a fun way to just inject some kind of your personality. In this world, it's similar to our world, and the things that happen in our world happen, but it's a world where magic is accepted and it's an everyday part of society, which I always love books that don't really hide magic, that really put it alongside people's lives. Because I think people think if there was magic, like all the world's problems would be solved and everybody would be happy and rich and healthy. But I always kind of think like, I don't think so. Like, I think that like magic would just make people probably feel a little lazy because they would fix their problems magically. And I think that you would probably have some people who are more powerful and some people who are less powerful. And like, I just think that it's not this panacea, that it would introduce a whole slew of problems that people wouldn't even have thought about. So in this world, magic is real. It's out there. It's accepted. And the main character does have a lot of issues with it because all the women in her family are water witches and they live on this whaling island. And her mother is the only woman in the family who has rejected this notion that she will sort of work in service to to the people of the island. And so she's kidnapped her daughter and taken her away from her grandmother, who's the current witch, and bidden her to ever use magic because she feels basically that it's not that great of a life, that you're kind of stuck in this cottage all by yourself and you're constantly being interrupted by people who are asking you for things, an emotionally and physically taxing way of life. And so she wants better for her daughter, but her daughter just wants what she thinks is her birthright. She wants to get back to her grandmother. I just love the idea that you could use magic to tell this really dynamic story between different generations. And that is something that I found more and more in introducing fantasy elements into my stories, is that you can use the fantasy elements to talk about things that I think otherwise might feel like a little too much, really. Like, I always like to joke that Salt and Storm is like sneakily a feminist book. You wouldn't be like knocked over the head with like feminist issues, but their magic is, in my mind, a very obvious metaphor for feminine power. And in the next book, Drift and Dagger, which is a prequel, takes place before the events of Salt and Storm and features a whole different character, I sort of took that fantasy to kind of hide bigger themes. I took that even further. The main character is a boy who is immune to magic. And so he lives in this magical world, but he's immune to magic, and it's something that he has to hide because people think that immunity to magic, he's forced to keep this huge part of himself a secret. And it leads to a lot of anger and self-loathing and confusion. And he's kind of constantly trying to figure out his place in the world. I wanted to write that book because I remember as a teenager, the things that made me different were the things that made me feel anxious and upset. And they were the things that I hated. And I wanted nothing more than to get rid of them. But now as an adult, the things that make me different are the things that I love about myself. So I wanted to write a book about how do you reach that point from really self-loathing to acceptance. That's the thing that I think a lot of teenagers go through. I don't know any teenager who feels 100% comfortable with every aspect of themselves. So I wanted to touch on that, but without kind of coming right out and saying, you know, this is a book about depression. It's a book about magic. And the main character just happens to have this kind of other aspect to his story.
If you were to give me a book about history, teaching me about history in high school, oh, I would have fallen asleep. I'll tell you right now. Right. I think you did such an amazing job. And I think just talking about what you mentioned before, that actually inspires me to ask you how you're able to create such strong characters with such depth.
There are always obviously parts of an author and a character, but I am nothing like Avery. I always felt there was something kind of unrelatable to characters who were so smart and so capable, and they never failed. Or if they did fail, it was like beautiful, tragic way that was perfect. I love the idea of starting with a character who's a little bratty and kind of a pain in the butt, and then seeing her grow and change and take two steps forward and one step back. You know, a lot of people tell me that Avery is not very likable. You know, I always think like, okay, I get it. Like, she's pretty thorny and she says things that I think are very rude. She's very sassy. She really feels like I have everything figured out and I am going to charge ahead with this plan and I don't care who I hurt because this is absolutely the right thing to do. And she realizes through the whole story kind of how wrong she is and how, you know, she doesn't have all the answers and she doesn't know the right thing to do in every single occasion. So that was the journey that I always envisioned for Avery.
I'd love to know your behind the scenes process because there's a lot going on in your book, but then you're able to tie it together so well. So that's what really interests me in wanting to know how you're able to do that and how you're able to map it out but make it cohesive.
You know, I think you have to know the rules before you break the rules is kind of something that I think about a lot. And you need to feel comfortable in a world before you can take liberties with it or describe it. So once I kind of finished the research portion, I started thinking about the story and what kind of story did I want to tell. And usually that starts with the overarching things that I want to tell. I usually have like a piece of paper and I'll write down the big theme, which will go on to be my roadmap for writing the book. So these themes were things about loneliness and isolation, the mother-daughter relationship, and identity, figuring out who you truly are when everybody around you has an opinion about who you are. Once I kind of had that idea, and those were the really big things that I wanted to talk about, it was a little bit easier to figure out a story that would tell those themes. You know, I wanted to talk about identity, so that was going to always be the biggest part of the book, this girl figuring out, who is she really? Is she really this going to be this witch, or is she something different? And does that require totally changing who she is? And is it a good thing to change who she is? So all of these sort of complex questions got thrown in there. And then it was really just figuring out, you know, what is her world and what kind of things would she be doing and what kind of people would she be interacting with? The actual writing process for me, I don't really have an outline.
Oh, wow.
But I always knew my beginning, that first chapter where she's learning the magic with her grandmother. That was always the first chapter. And the last chapter, or the last scene, was always the last scene. So neither of those changed. I always knew that that was the beginning and then that was the end. For me, I describe it as like driving a car down a dark road,
mm-hmm.
and you know where you're going and you can see what's in front of your headlight, but you can't really see anything beyond that. You discover a lot as you go along. And this book, more than any other thing that I've written, has been through really extensive edits. So I wrote this book and then I edited it myself. And then I got an agent and I edited it with my agent. And then I got an editor and it went through a full year of edits. It's sort of an interesting way to write a book. I just was like basically in a groove the whole time I was writing this book that I would reach a plot point at the end of the day and I wasn't sure what to do next. And I remember literally like every single day, I'd just be like, well, I'll figure it out. And then I would like finish my work for the day. And I usually go do something else. Or like, as I was falling asleep, I would be thinking about my book. And then I would figure out the problem to my plot point and sit down the next day and everything would like work out perfectly. And I don't know what I was thinking. Obviously, I did not have a child at that point. And so I was not a brain dead as I am right now. You know, you sort of realize that EP does not necessarily translate to good. And difficult does not necessarily translate to bad.
Was there a point where you felt really stuck and you felt like you ran into a wall? Were there moments like that for you? And how were you able to get out of that?
To me, that's like what writing is like you write until you hit a wall and then you figure out what is the problem. And then you figure out how to get around it or go through it or, you know, backtrack and try another way until you reach a point where you feel satisfied with it. And sometimes that reaching a point where you feel satisfied with it doesn't happen until you hit like 6 or 7 different revisions. The book that I'm working on right now, I love it. And it's definitely by far my favorite thing that I've ever written. To me, it's just like one series of writer's block after another. It's a very complex story. And I'm trying to tell it in a very natural way, which means that the opening chapter, I've honestly rewritten it, I would say easily 20 times. And I'm not even through with the first draft. Like there's still 30,000 words of this story that I want to write. I'm like, well, I just don't know where this book is going next. It just comes back to thinking again about the big themes that I want to tell. And how do I make sure that I'm telling that chapter by chapter or page by page or line by line? Like I always want to feel like I'm an overarching story. That's usually writing something that I feel really good about. And I think all of writing is like figuring out what gets me asking more questions and wanting to write and wanting to tell that story. when I hit writer's block, it's usually because I've strayed from that sort of like exciting moment. And so how do I get it back is kind of how I work through it. I do have an office at home, but lately I've been working at a coffee shop down the street. And I joke that I work there because it's like publicly unacceptable to just like fall on the floor sobbing about how much like you hate your book, because that's like what I would be doing if I was home. You know, that's the work. I make sure that I have a very strict writing schedule. And if I spend those hours mindlessly staring at my book until like my brain figures something out, or if I spend those hours working, it kind of doesn't make any difference, but I'm going to be there anyway. These sort of like break in writer's block happen in ways that you would never experience, that you're talking to somebody or you're reading something and somebody says something or you hear something that makes you think like, aha, like, yeah, okay, that's interesting.
Now, when you mentioned your strict writing schedule, can you share that with us so that I can find some inspiration for myself and for listeners as well?
Yeah, my situation is maybe a little unique because I write full time and I used to write 5 days a week. And I would try to do 9 to 5. And usually I was doing other things related to that, which I'm still doing other things. I have a lot of, you know, kind of other writing responsibilities or author responsibilities. Like this is technically like doing a podcast is like built it into my schedule for mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. Right now I have a toddler. I have a 1.5-year-old. Her first year, she was home with me every day, which was great. I loved it. It was wonderful. I love my daughter. She's fantastic. But it was basically impossible to get any kind of work done. So now she goes to daycare 3 days a week. And those 3 days are my work days. Usually what happens is I get up at 9 because I can sleep in a little bit, which is nice. Because it's cold. My office is on the top floor and it's not heated, so it's very cold in there right now. So lately I've been like working from bed, which is very lazy and luxurious, and usually with my dog with me, which in general I will say I think having a dog in bed with you is really disgusting, but my dog is really warm and furry, and so I in the winter months we're like a little bit more lenient with her, but she doesn't sleep with us up there. She sleeps under the bed.
Oh. So
I have my laptop with me, and I usually from like 9 until 11, I'm kind of like writing emails or taking care of administrative stuff. And then usually around like 11, I'll take the dog out for a nice long walk, although that's been shorter lately because it's freezing outside. And then usually on that walk, also, I'm thinking about what I want to work on and what I want to accomplish for that day. So then I get home and get all my stuff. I walk out to the coffee shop down the street and I work there usually from like 12 until 4:45, which is when I have to go pick up my daughter. I sort of found that dedicating those almost 5 hours a day to writing is really like the max that I can do, which was something that I noticed when I was working 5 days a week, 9 to 5, that I sort of felt like when you have so much time on your hands, you don't really let ideas sit and settle. Like I would write a chapter and I'd feel really good about it. And then I would have like still another 4 hours left in the day. So I would just start on the next chapter. Mm. And not that there's anything necessarily bad with that, but I noticed that when I only have time to maybe work on one chapter a day, I can close my laptop and then I have the rest of evening to think about it. And then I have the next morning to think about it. And when I start working again, I'm in a more thoughtful place. I actually really love just having that limited time every day to write, which I still think 15 hours a week is like, you know, it's a pretty good.
It's a lot. Yeah. Kendall, I'm curious because I know you said that you have writing work, like all different kinds and not just writing your books. So that does make me wonder, have you been writing like straight out from college? Have you just been consistently writing and have been able to support yourself through writing?
So I assume you're talking about finances. So I write full time now, but when I got out of college and I graduated debt-free, which I realize is not a...
What?
I know. I realize it's not like practical for...
That's like unheard of. Did you get grants and scholarships?
I did. So,
oh, that's so awesome.
Harvard is extremely generous with financial aid. So after college, I went into journalism. That was what I thought I was going to do. I had interned for a couple summers with Bloomberg News in New York. So they offered me a job when I graduated, and they are sort of unique in the journalism world. They are a private company that actually pays their journalists very, very well. So even as a journalist, I was able to make enough.
Oh, wow.
I worked there for 3 years before I decided to try to write full time. And at that point, I'd been working on a manuscript and I was feeling really good about it. And I decided to take the plunge and try to publish it. At the time I was in New York, my now husband was in Chicago in grad school. We were engaged and we were looking for basically a way to figure out, like, how could we be in the same place and how could we get married? I didn't really love my job. I was getting really disillusioned with journalism. I really wanted to try writing and I felt like I had savings. So I decided to quit my job and move to Chicago. And the idea was that I was going to be working on this, like, basically for as long as I needed to. And I always thought I left my company on very good terms and they had an office in Chicago. I kept in contact with the people who I worked with, both at Bloomberg and elsewhere. So I kind of felt like if I needed to go back to an office, it wouldn't be impossible. We were in Chicago and we were living off of, my husband went to economic grad school in Chicago and he was applying to the school. They got like an incredible grant just for his program. So he managed to actually get a living stipend, which was very unheard of. So that kind of took care of our living expenses for the most part. Felt like I didn't really have a lot of pressure to get a job. And my husband has always been amazingly supportive. He always felt like if it was going to be time taken away from writing, that my time was valuable and that if my time was better served writing or going out and meeting other authors or connecting with agents, that that was a better use of my time. Then I got my publishing deal. So I got my first advance check. And, you know, I'm not like a millionaire, but it's doing fine. Like, I'm actually like able to somewhat support myself. And now we live in Boston. My husband works full time. And so I always say if I can make enough to cover my daughter's daycare, then I will feel satisfied that like this is like a good use of my time.
That's so awesome. Congratulations, by the way. That's something to be really proud of.
Thank you. Well, it's always a little bit stressful because I don't have a publishing deal right now. So trying to like hustle to finish this book so that I can, not necessarily like I'm driven by money or anything, but it's tough to kind of to support yourself as a writer these days that, you know, the advances are getting smaller and the royalties is getting even smaller.
Switching gears, what's really exciting you in your work right now? I know you mentioned that you're working on something. I'm not sure if you're allowed to talk about it, but if you want to hint at it so that we know to look out for it.
I think I can talk about it probably a little bit. So it's not under contract anywhere. So it's not like a publisher is going to be like mad at me or something. So I'm writing a Western. I love it so much. It's a book that way back when I was trying to get an agent for Salt and Storm, I was working on this book. So I've been working on it since 2012, which feels so crazy to me that it's always kind of been in the back of my mind. It's another historical fantasy. So it's about ghost hunting in the Wild West.
Ooh, I like that. That's awesome.
It's really, really, really fun. It's a really different book than anything that I've ever written. And it has a couple big mystery elements. And it's like a father-daughter story. And it's kind of a twist on True Grit a little bit, which is another really great father-daughter Western. So to come up with all that stuff and then to have it all connect in a way that is satisfying, that's all been like tough.
It's a puzzle piece for sure.
Yeah. I'm trying to like assemble a puzzle underwater, blindfold.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I'm hoping that it will be done in the spring.
Awesome.
And then my agent will be sending it out to editors and publishing houses. And hopefully it will be on shelves maybe like in the next 2 years or so. It feels so far away, but
before you know it, you'll be blinking and it's like, oh, it's here already. For listeners who are working on stories that are their first debut novels and they have no idea how to go about getting literary agents or are feeling very fearful or blindsided, How would you advise them to go about it?
There's definitely the practical advice, which is make sure your query letter is very strong and make sure that you really research an agent before you contact them. They need to have demonstrated some sort of interest in the kind of book that you're writing, or have a client that has written similar, although not exactly similar, book. Or sometimes, like a lot of times, they go on Twitter and they'll say, like, I really want like a space combined with Project Romeo and Juliet or something like that. So, you know, if that happens to be what you're writing, then you can contact them and say, I saw that this is something you were looking at. I always feel like it's important to have like some sort of personal connection with your agent or with somebody that you're querying, just so that the agent feels like you're not just shot your manuscript to everybody.
Yeah. You're actually tailoring and spending time.
Right.
It's interesting because I notice now when you mention that about Twitter, I see literary agents are all over Twitter and putting out requests like, we're seeking to represent new clients in the young adult fantasy fiction world, for example. It wasn't like that years ago. Now I feel like it makes way more convenient and accessible.
It's a really big help. And there's a way to search your agents. Twitter feed, if you Google, because it's like a little complicated to explain over a podcast, if you Google like how to search somebody's Twitter feed, you can actually search just one person's, all the tweets that they've said.
Oh, wow.
If you're writing like a fantasy, you can search for any time they've mentioned fantasy or something like that. That was really, really helpful when I was trying to get my queries together.
I didn't even know they had that function for Twitter.
It's not for Twitter. That is a little too complicated to explain. But if you Google how to search somebody's Twitter feed,
it'll pop up.
Yeah, something will pop up and tell you.
Oh, wow. Thank you for that.
It's an emotional process for sure. Like you're writing in a bubble and you're basically like all by yourself and maybe only like a handful of people have ever read anything that you've ever written. And then you're kind of like sending your baby out into the world. And for the most part, like it's just getting like slapped down immediately. It's important to remember that literally every author goes through this process. I don't know anybody who has not gotten one rejection, or anybody who has not gotten 50 rejections. Like, you know, it's that's just part of the game. Some people take it personally, but like the reality is agents love books. Most of them are very smart and they read a lot, so they know what is good. And as hard a pill as it is to swallow sometimes, if you're getting a lot of rejections, it means that your book is not good enough. But instead of thinking of it as like, my book is not good enough and I'm a terrible writer, like think of it as, how do I make it better? How do I make myself a better writer? If you think about it logically, it's the first time you've ever tried to write a book for the most part. And when has anybody ever been completely successful on the first attempt at doing something? Like, it takes time. Like, for me, Salt and Storm was the third manuscript that I wrote before I got an agent. And honestly, thank the Lord that agents rejected those first two manuscripts because they were terrible. When you're a new writer, it's very hard to see the flaws in your own work. I would say almost impossible. And like, I feel like I have a very good perspective on my writing. Like, I'm not precious about it and I'm very happy to like tear it down and make it better. When I was writing that first novel, I honestly thought it was the very best that I could do. And it probably was the very best I could do at that time. I needed to hear like 45 strangers be like, no, this is not actually very good, before like I was willing to say like, okay, well, like they're probably not all wrong. So maybe I need to go back and write a new book. And then I made that one all perfect and I sent it out into the world and that one got rejections as well. And instead of thinking like, well, like those are two books down the drain, I just kind of felt like, well, I've learned so much about how to be a better writer. And writing those manuscripts, you can take all the classes in the world, but nothing is ever going to teach you to write better as much as actually writing something. So when people are getting ready to send their first manuscript out into querying, like I always say, like, well, what are you working on right now? Because you need to have another project while you're querying, not just because it gives you something else to focus on, that you're not all like putting your eggs in one basket, but it kind of will get you ready for the reality of publishing, especially if you're publishing YA. You have to be putting out a new book if not every year, then pretty close to that. You know, teenagers are teenagers for a very small window of time. You don't really have the luxury to have 3 years in between books. You can like focus entirely on one book. And then once that book is all done, then you can sit down and focus entirely on another book. Like, no, you have to write these books very, very fast.
I was reading somewhere and I was a little confused because I thought that you need to have your full manuscript ready before even sending off that query. But then I read somewhere else that you don't have to complete your full manuscript, but you should have a really good idea about what your book outline should be, like a very detailed one. Do you know anything about that? Can you weigh in on that?
Yes. If you're writing fiction, you need to have a manuscript. It has to be totally complete. If you're writing nonfiction, you write generally on proposal. So you have an idea.
Oh.
And so the idea is that your advance when you're writing nonfiction goes to funding the research for you to finish the rest of the book. One of the other things that I'll just mention is if you're writing a series, if you would like to write a series, some people think that they need to have completed the whole series before they queried. But actually, you should just have the first book that you want to send, and every book, even the first in a series, should feel like it could be a standalone novel. And at the very most, you can have outlines for your next stories in the series. But a lot of times what happens is you may be convinced that this story can only be told in a 5-book series, and then your book gets sold to a publisher, and the publisher says, actually, we just want you to write a 2-book series. So all those 5 books worth of stories, you're going to have to cram into 2 books. So a lot of wonky things can happen when you're writing series. So if you are trying to write that, just write 1 book and then think about the other ones later.
I would love for you to recommend any of your favorite books that have helped you as a writer or inspired you that we can check out.
Oh, yeah. So my top favorite book ever is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Oh, yes.
It is so wonderful. Mm-hmm. If I talk about it too much, I'm going to start crying. It's like one of the best books that I've ever read. And every time I read it, the first time I read it, I was 12 years old, which is like basically the same age as the main character. And every time I read it, now I have a baby, and now I read it as like the perspective of a parent. And it grows with you and it changes with you. It's so beautiful. I love it. I love it. I love it. So that is by far my favorite book. I always have to talk about it. As far as like books that have taught me writing, really the best books are not like how to write a book, but just good stories. So like I always say, if you want to write, you need to read.
Mm.
And things that are similar to what you want to be writing and things that are totally opposite. And you should read classics and you should read like trashy books that are really popular. Because they're clearly doing something right. Like millions and millions of copies. Those are always the books that I really recommend. If you're writing historical fiction, it always is helpful to read books that are in that genre. Yeah, I mean, you kind of never know like what is going to inspire you next. A book that I think is really fun that I think a lot of people haven't heard of is this book called The Art of Looking Sideways.
Hmm.
It's not really about writing. It's the collected work of a very famous graphic designer named Alan Fletcher. He's British. And it is so fascinating, the creative process and how he looks at the world. And it's broken into different chapters about perspective and color and value and shade. And it's very cool. It's filled with lots of really interesting quotes by different innovators and creators and authors and painters and things like that. And it's a very inspiring book. So sometimes when I'm sort of feeling like a little lost, I'll just sort of sit down with it and flip through it. I'm actually sitting in front of my bookshelf right now.
Oh, I love that. Thank you.
One of the books that I just read, this is like not a writing book, but I've been plugging it to everybody. The Poisoner's Handbook.
Oh, okay.
It's about the creation. This is going to sound very strange. There's a point. I promise. It's about the creation of the country's first, basically, forensic science.
Oh, it's interesting.
Crime laboratory. And it's about the chief coroner and then his head chemist and basically how the two of them created chemical forensic science and using science to investigate usually like murders or homicides. It is so fascinating. It's like true crime and science and history and a really compelling character case. And I've been recommending it to everybody because it's really, really good. And it's a book that tells a story about history in a very compelling way.
And Kendall, can you tell us where we can find you on social media to say hi?
Yeah, definitely. So my website is kendallkolper.com. I'm on Twitter at Kendall_Kolper. Although, I don't know if this is a plus or minus, but basically my Twitter feed is just pictures of my dog. So that's
actually 10 million pluses. Duh.
So if you like pictures of dogs, lazy dogs, then come to my Twitter feed. And then I'm on Facebook. If you just search Kendall Kolper, author.
And that wraps up our episode with a super sweet and awesome Kendall Kolper today. A big thank you to Kendall for being on the show and for sharing everything so candidly. I loved hearing about her journey as an author. And thank you, storytellers, for listening in. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode and learned lots from it. For a list of the books and resources mentioned in Kendall's episode, be sure to visit 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Kendall Kolper. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.